Good morning. Welcome back to social psychology, and welcome in particular all the school students from the Einhard Schule in Seligenstadt. What was Einhard? Einhard was a consultant of Karl der Große. Yeah. Good to know. It's your lucky day because today we will talk about sex. And I will reveal all the answers that you always wanted to know but never dared to ask. So the topic of today is attraction and close relationships. We will talk about affiliation, we will talk about love, and we will talk about attractiveness and what it does. This is the last question. Next week we will have a revision session. So every student who wants to come along and ask questions in preparation for the final exam can do so. We will also record the session next week for the students off campus in the MOOC. Let's quickly explore the questions of last week when we talked about pro-social behavior. Pro-social behavior can generally be defined as acts that are positively valued by society, are intended to benefit someone else, are performed without expecting any gain, or define the best kind of society in which to live. Yes, please. Correct, and almost everyone got this one right, and we discussed that this would be helping behavior, this would be altruism, and this is an error. So pro-social behavior is any act that is positively valued by society. Now we have a little bit of a tricky question because the answers were interesting. When Kitty Genovese was murdered in 1964, the crime shocked the public. This was because the New York police force had been particularly callous. Only one person went to her aid. Witnesses were unconcerned, or many local people appeared callous or unconcerned. More people got this one wrong than right, and I do understand why, because technically it's very difficult to differentiate between these two. I mean, there were people around. About 38 people had witnessed the account in some way or the other. But later on, it was found that it was not witnesses in a juridical or trial sense, so no one of them could come forward as a witness and clearly identify the perpetrator. So therefore, the correct answer is many local people appeared callous or unconcerned, but I do understand why some of you have picked answer C, and I will make sure that if I ask the same question, I will provide different answer alternatives in the exam. A person's motivation for helping after experiencing distress from someone else's distress is called altruism, empathy, principalism, or obligation.
Yes.
Exactly. 88% got this one right, and you may remember Gregory Bateson and his empathy altruism hypothesis. He claims that when we have empathy with another person and we help because we feel as the other person feels, then we can speak about true altruism. And then it's not about gaining a reward or asking for reciprocity, etc. There is a paradox. The likelihood of helping someone in distress decreases as the number of potential helpers increases. This can be accounted for to some extent by social loafing, lack of empathy, independence in Western cultures, or the diffusion of responsibility. That's correct, and almost everyone else who participated shows the correct number as well. What were the other two factors that account for the bystander effect? What precedes the diffusion of responsibility factor and what follows the diffusion of responsibility factor? When you are in a situation, yes, please.
It's not perceiving the imaginary or crowd inhibition, audience inhibition?
Exactly. So we start with pluralistic ignorance. The more people are around, the less likely we interpret the situation as an emergency, because in a split second we see others who behave callous or seem unconcerned, so we interpret the situation often not as serious as it is. Then the diffusion of responsibility effect kicks in, so we may interpret it as an emergency, but we see other people around, so we give away the responsibility to others. And even if you assume responsibility and think, yes, I should do something, then we behave less likely in a helpful manner because we fear that the crowd around, the audience, will laugh at us, ridicule us when we do something wrong. I forgot to mention last week, the good news is, from the bystander effect, it seems that having other people around is always bad. The good news is, when there are other people around and someone takes the first move and provides help, then of course the likelihood that others join in is higher, and help with more than just one person may be much more effective. Because one person can attend to the victim, one person can call the ambulance or the police, etc. And if you are ever in a position of being a victim in such an emergency, the best thing you can do is to clearly identify one person in a crowd and say, please, you with the black coat, can you please call the police? Then you have interrupted the pluralistic ignorance. You as a victim make clear, there is an emergency, and I want you to do something, so you interrupt the diffusion of responsibility, and you make it less likely that this person you attend to has a fear of social blunders, because if you tell her, please call the police, then no one can ridicule you for doing so, okay? Any questions? Good. Then I would like you to take a piece of paper and think about an ideal partner, in a romantic relationship. And please write down the three characteristics that are most important for you. Who would you look for? How should this person be? Three characteristics for an ideal romantic partner. Okay, and then please write down the three characteristics that are most important to you in your actual partner, if you have one. So, this morning I uploaded a very interesting paper on the MOOC platform. This is called Women, Men, and the Bedroom: Methodological and Conceptual Insights that Narrow, Reframe, and Eliminate Gender Differences in Sexuality. And this paper deals with some myths or stereotypes that we do have about male and female differences in sexuality. The first stereotype that they deal with is men and women have different preferences for the qualities of their partners. And I did this little exercise for several years here in Frankfurt, and sometimes I collected a few of the pieces of paper that you wrote your qualities or characteristics on. And typically, by and large, I can confirm, even with psychology or school students here in Frankfurt, that there is something about the stereotype that men prefer sexy women, whereas women want high-status men. So typically what you find when when men note their three characteristics, they refer to good looks, physical attractiveness and these things, whereas women more often than men refer to reliability, should provide security, safety, and these things. At the end of the lecture, I will reveal the answers to these questions, but maybe now for 5 minutes, discuss with one or two people next to you one or two of these questions that you are probably most interested in, like whether women orgasm less frequently than men, or whether women are choosier, more selective than men. Just discuss and think whether you believe that these stereotypes are true or not. Okay. May I have your attention back, please? So how many of you think that women actually orgasm less frequently than men? No one. That's interesting. Who thinks that men think about sex more often than women? All the women. Okay, I will tell you the answers at the end of the lecture. So the teaching objectives for today are in general to consider the basis for affiliation. So I will answer this gentleman's question whether he needs any friends or not. attraction and love. In particular, we will examine the negative consequences of isolation. Specific factors that affect our attraction to others. We will discuss the nature, maintenance, not so much the dissolution of loving relationships today. So why do we affiliate in the first place? What makes people attractive, and does it make a difference whether we are attractive or not? And how can we define and scientifically explore intimate relationships and love relationships? So affiliative behavior can be defined as any act that indicates that a person chooses to be with others. And everyone has a need for affiliation. Every human being, and it seems animals too, have a need to be with others. Affiliation seems to be one of the basic, the fundamental needs of all living beings. But the strength of this need can vary from person to person. Some people are very high on the need for affiliation, others are rather low. I also deal with this topic in a lecture on organizational behavior when we discuss people's different needs and motivations at work. And some people have a high need for power. These people are typically the ones who strive to become leaders or managers in organizations. Other people have a high need for affiliation, and these people make good team players. And these people are particularly unhappy when they work in situations in which they are mostly isolated and on their own. If they have a high need for affiliation, they should choose or be placed in contexts in which people work together in teams. And it also seems that a too high need for affiliation is not particularly good for becoming leaders, because then you are too much concerned with harmony in teams and groups than with getting the job done. And often as managers or leaders, this also involves some criticism, negative aspects, etc. So the need for affiliation is there in every one of us, but whether we have a high or a medium or a low need for affiliation varies. Why do we affiliate? Why do we need others? Why do we want to be around with others? Because isolation hurts. It doesn't feel good. In many experiments, people play little computer games, and then the computer makes them feel isolated. The classic experiment is that you are told that you are playing a little computer game like a sort of frisbee with two other players in separate rooms. So you are player A on your computer screen, and then there are two other players, and then you are throwing the disc to one of the other players, he or she is throwing it to the next one, this one is throwing it back to you, like every normal game of frisbee you would play with two other players. And at some stage, the computer manipulates the players so that you are player A and player B and C only playing the disc back and forth, and they ignore you. And this makes people feel isolated, and this makes people feel bad. We don't like that. Even a few minutes of not being part of the game of two anonymous computer game, other computer players, makes us feel bad. We don't like it. It does hurt. But it also has tremendous negative consequences of our cognitive and social functioning in the long run. This was studied by Harlow in 1958, who took newborn rhesus monkeys and put them in cages with so-called surrogate mothers. These were monkey mothers made from wire. They had a fur. They had some sort of artificial face. They rocketed a little bit, and they provided milk. But apparently, they didn't communicate with the monkey babies the way real monkey mothers would do. And this led to seriously impairment of cognitive and social functioning of the rhesus monkeys. After a few weeks, these rhesus monkeys were far below the stage of cognitive development than the rhesus monkeys who had been raised with real mothers. They felt isolated. They were not able, as adult monkeys, to have a normal sexual life. They were biting themselves. They were not able to handle conflicts, etc. So a few weeks with these surrogate mothers destroys our basis, our fundament for normal cognitive and social functioning. Good morning, Mrs. Walker. And this can also be generalized to humans. In developmental psychology, you may have heard of Bowlby. Bowlby and his development of the attachment style theory. And he based his work on Harlow and also Spitz. Spitz in 1945 found that children in overcrowded hospitals, and this was in the 1940s, in overcrowded hospitals who were given to the hospital by mothers who felt that they couldn't take care of their children. But at that time, it was a very different hospital situation than it is today. I was born in 1967, and both my brother and I had our tonsils taken away. And at that time, that was the early 1970s, you were taken away out of your family, put into hospital for about 2 weeks, and your parents were only allowed to visit you on the weekends for 1 hour every day. So this could be a serious problem for small children, and particularly so in situations when the hospital staff, the nurses, had so many other things to do that they couldn't even take care of the little babies. And Spitz found that basically the same that Harlow found for the rhesus monkeys happened to the children. He called this hospitalism, and he found seriously impairment of the cognitive development and social functioning of these children as adults. So a few weeks in a hospital at a very young stage already make our cognitive and social development become much worse. So we need to affiliate with others because this helps us develop in a normal way. Stanley Schachter was one of the first social psychologists who did experiments on this. And in one of his classic experiments in 1959, he asked female participants to come into the laboratory, and then he explained to them that they would later on do a little memory test, and that they were given electric shocks if they were making any mistakes. And confederates of Schachter role-played that these shocks were either relatively harmless or indeed very painful. So in the painful, in the high anxiety condition, the female participants experienced much more anxiety than in the low anxiety condition. This was so-called the manipulation check. And then Schachter asked them whether they would like to wait alone for the experiment to start or whether they would prefer to wait with other participants. In the high anxiety condition, 63% of the participants elected to wait with other participants. In the low anxiety condition, only 33% wanted to wait with others. So two-thirds didn't care whether they were waiting with others or alone. But when anxiety is high, this renders our need for affiliation or our desire to be with others higher. Kulik and colleagues did a study in a hospital in the 1990s, and they investigated patients who were waiting to get heart surgery, coronary surgery. These were the patients that had no roommate, who were waiting for their operation before and waiting after the operation to be dismissed from the hospital alone in their rooms. And you can see for every dependent variable, ambulation, that is how many yards they walked around after after heart surgery. The level of ambulation is an indicator of the success of the surgery. The more you are able to walk around postoperatively, the better it is. So the number of yards, and this was a self-reported number of yards. So patients were asked in questionnaires, how much do you think you walked around today? The number of yards was higher in all of these conditions than it was in the no roommate condition. They also carried an activity monitor that provided an objective measure of ambulation. And again, when there was no roommate, ambulation was typically lower than in the other conditions, except two, I will come to in a moment. And the post-operative length of stay, so the number of days they had to stay in hospital after the surgery before they were dismissed, is higher in the no roommate condition than in all the other conditions. Now let's look at the other conditions. So being in a room with one other roommate seems to help. For almost all the dependent variables, it's better for them to be in a room with others than to be in a room alone. But it also seems that it's better to wait with a patient who has the same problem. So the ambulation self-report is higher for if the roommate was another cardiac patient, then it was a different treatment this patient was in hospital for. Also for ambulation, you see the objective measure is much higher, twice as high as if the patient was non-cardiac. And on average, people who waited with a cardiac patient were dismissed from the hospital more than a day earlier than people who waited with a non-cardiac person. And also the operative status mattered. People seem to prefer to wait with people who are already post-operative. And we can explain this by if we stay in a room with a patient who has already had his treatment, this person apparently has survived and takes away some of the anxiety that is involved in waiting for getting a serious treatment such as coronary surgery. And you see when people had to wait with someone who already has had his operation, number of days in hospital were shorter than when they waited with someone who was also expecting the operation. Ambulation was much higher, both in an objective and in a subjective way. So both Schachter's study in an experiment and the real-life study of Kulik show that it is good to be around others. It reduces our anxiety and it makes it more likely that we cope with the problems. You are laughing?
I would have a different explanation of that, to be honest.
Okay.
I would say, for example, in terms of this roommate operative status, I would say maybe the people that just came out of the operation, if you're in the same room with them, they're a lot more annoying. That's why you're walking around outside more, so that you don't have to be in the same room with them.
I'm not sure. Yeah, it may be one other explanation, but It also depends on whether you are hospital for getting a child than for getting heart surgery. I think for getting heart surgery, your main concern is, will I survive this? And being around with others who can take away some of the anxiety that is involved does help. Let's move to attraction. What makes one person feel positively about another? One factor is physical attractiveness. Other factors are proximity, reciprocity, similarity, and self-disclosure, and we go through them one by one. Do people agree who is beautiful and who is not? And what makes beauty? And there's this saying, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and this may be true, but there are also, there seem to be some universal factors that contribute to people being perceived as more attractive than others. So Ray McCooney, so if you have to rate this person as not at all attractive to very attractive, probably many people would agree that at least the way he's dressed up here, he doesn't make a particularly attractive male person. Duffy, the only gay in the village, probably is attractive in the eyes of some people, or maybe not the majority. Carla B., many people would agree that she is quite attractive. How come? It has to do with our facial characteristics. Typically in women, men prefer large eyes and high cheekbones. Typically we prefer symmetry, but not perfect symmetry. And for men, estimating or evaluating females' attractiveness, it's a certain hip-to-waist ratio that we find attractive that signals reproductive fitness. So the Barbie doll would not necessarily be considered particularly reproductively fit because her hip-to-waist ratio actually renders her not fit to get any children delivered. But apparently she has the characteristics in her face of symmetry, large eyes, high cheekbones. How can we estimate whether people now agree that some people are attractive and others are less attractive? We can calculate the correlation of multiple ratings of two raters. So we have the covariation of rater 1 and rater 2 divided by the product of the standard deviations. Rosenthal has suggested another way. He calls this the effective reliability. So we take the correlation, multiply it by the number of raters, divided by this term, and then we have the effective reliability of several raters, which should be a more accurate way of determining whether people agree on people's attractiveness or not. Why should people agree on attractiveness? Why is attractiveness not only in the eye of the beholder? There are two theories. Socialization and social expectancy theory would say that our cultural norms influence our perception. So attractiveness in some cultures is different from attractiveness in other cultures, and every culture forms some sort of a norm, whether, for example, body size, larger or smaller, is attractive or less attractive. But there are also evolutionary theories, fitness-related theories. Beauty signals health. If we see a beautiful woman, then this woman may have better genes, and this may render our gene pool more attractive if I partner with her and get children with her than when I partner with a less attractive woman, and the same is true for females' choice in mating partners. Because beauty signals reproductive fitness, and that may be more important for men than for women. But also differential parental solicitude is one of the evolutionary-based theories. It seems that parents tend to invest more in their more attractive children than in their lesser attractive children. And evolutionary psychologists explain this also with these children being more fit than others. So do people agree who is attractive or not? Langlois et al. Conducted a meta-analysis, and you see that they had quite large sample sizes. So adults within culture, there were 88 samples in 67 studies, altogether 1,500 people. The mean correlation is 0.47, and the effective mean calculated after Rosenthal is 0.90. Children within one culture, here we have slightly fewer studies, but still over 1,000 participants. The average correlation is 0.20. The effective reliability is 0.85. If we look at it cross-culturally, we still find large effect sizes, and we do find it both cross-cultural and cross-ethnic groups, but you see here the number of studies becomes relatively small. So there's also some heterogeneity, but by and large, these effect sizes indicate that, yes, we do agree who is attractive or not. If you have multiple raters who we show, say, photos or little videos, then people typically agree on the attractiveness of others. But does it matter? Does it matter whether we are good-looking or less good-looking? One experiment by Lendy and Siegel, they produced two essays. One essay was good, the other essay was poor. And then they gave the essays to multiple raters and asked them to evaluate the quality of one of these two essays, either the good one or the poor one. A control group didn't have a photo attached to the essay at all, and you see that the difference between the good essay and the poor essay of the control group probably reflects the real difference between the content of the two essays. So in the control group, the evaluators of the good essay evaluated with a 7 out of 8 point, those of the poor essay evaluated with 5 point something out of 8. If the essay came with an attractive photo, participants rated the essay, the good essay, even better than the control group, but they also rated the poor essay better than the control group. When the essay came with an unattractive photo, the opposite occurred, and the good essay was rated less good than the control group, and the poor essay was rated particularly poor and much poorer than the control group and the attractive group. So it seems to matter. In a control experiment with one and the same essay, people paid attention to whether, oh, I shouldn't mention, it was all male participants, and the essay came with photos of a female, either an attractive or an unattractive female writer of the essay. But apparently, in this situation, in a control experiment, the difference in the attractiveness in the little photograph made the essay look completely different. The poor essay with the unattractive photograph was rated much, much worse than all the other conditions. The good essay with an unattractive photo was still rated better than the poor essays, but less so than in the control group and in the group with the attractive essay. Does it matter in the real world? I mean, rating essays is something that we as lecturers or your school teachers do all the time. So does it matter whether you are looking good, whether you are good-looking school students or university students? Does it influence your teacher's perception? Maybe it does. We cannot conclude from just one experiment, but we can look at other studies. And again, here's a meta-analysis that summarizes, for example, 13 studies about children with, on average, 1,500 children, and the mean effect size was 1.1. So it's quite a large effect that tells us the attractive children are evaluated better than the less attractive children. And you see that this is true for academic competence, for adjustment, for interpersonal competence, and for social appeal. In each of these areas, we have about 3 studies, and the effect sizes vary from 0.92 to 1.3, which are quite large, substantial effect sizes. So yes, across all these studies, we see that children who are more attractive are also more positively evaluated. And we see that the same is true for adults, although on a slightly lower level. So the effect sizes are not so strong here anymore. But with children, it seems to matter quite a lot whether you are attractive or not. And this is something we should know. And this is something that we should actively try to avoid as teachers or as evaluators. And this is something, these findings have led to legislations in the United States, in some European countries, that forbid you to put a photograph with your job application, because it puts you on an unfair advantage if for whatever reason you are more attractive, and it particularly puts those at a disadvantage who are by nature not having perfect symmetry, not particularly high cheekbones, etc. And this should not matter because it does not affect our real academic performance. Okay? So how do we choose who we like? First, it's attractiveness. Yes, it does matter, and we tend to like people more who are attractive. Another effect is propinquity, the person next door. This is a finding that the more we see and interact with people, the more likely they are to become our friends. This has been studied very early on in 1943 by a sociologist, Kennedy. He looked at an area in New Haven and marriage rates. And what he found was that people are more likely to marry if they are living close to each other. So 10% of marriages, both in 1930 and in 1940, 10% of all married couples lived in this at the same address, so in the same block, before they married. 30% lived within 5 blocks, and then we have cumulative numbers. Within 20 blocks, 65% and 76% respectively. Over 20 blocks, only 1/3 or 1/4 of the people. So yes, it does matter. If you live together in close proximity, 1, 2, 5 within 20 blocks, the likelihood that you marry is higher than when you live over 20 blocks away. But do distances as small as 20 feet also matter? And here we have one of the rare field studies that allow us to answer these questions. Festinger and colleagues were able to conduct a study. This was a housing project for veterans from the US Army who returned from serving military service in Europe after World War II. So this was between 1945 and 1950. And these veterans returned, and rooms were allocated to them on a first-come, first-served basis. So there was no selection on background or preferences or personality tests. Was simply a first-come, first-served basis. Whoever applied first got the first room, the next one the next room, etc., etc. And what Festinger and colleagues found, that people who were living in arrangements where there was a likelihood that they meet each other more often, also become friends. So the number of friendship formed were higher for people in apartments 7 and 1 than for 7 and 2. It was higher for people living in apartments 9 and 5 than those living in apartments 9 and 4. Although the physical distance was the same, the likelihood that these two people became friends or these two people became friends was higher, because sharing the same staircase made it more likely that they encounter each other, that they interact with each other. So yes, proximity, living close to others, makes it more likely that we meet and engage and interact with them. And this makes it more likely that we like them and become friends with them more often. A newer study, Colette van Laar in 2005 did a study on intergroup contact. And she surveyed people who lived together, students who lived together with roommates of different or the same ethnic group. So this is an indicator of roommate heterogeneity. Do you stay in student dorms together with, if you are white, only one or two other white students, or do you stay together with one black and one Latino person? And the greater the heterogeneity, the more positive students were against people from different ethnic groups. And this is particularly true if people if they have a higher number of Asian American roommates, then they are particularly positive towards Asian Americans. If people had a higher number of black roommates, they were particularly positive about other blacks. For Latinos, it doesn't work so well. So if we stay, if these students stay with Latino roommates, they only have a more positive effect toward blacks. I don't know why, and I don't know how Colette von Lahr and her colleagues interpreted this. But by and large, what we do see, if we look at the diagonal and if we look at these effects, yes, it does matter whether we are put together in a dorm with students from other ethnic groups. It increases our likelihood. And remember, we talked about this on the lecture on prejudice or intergroup relations. Contact helps. Getting in contact, in touch with other ethnic groups, typically makes our attitudes more positive than negative. One of the mechanisms that is involved in these propinquity effects is the so-called mere exposure effect. Bob Zients called the mere exposure effect, or he invented the mere exposure effect, and he stated, mere repeated exposure of the individual to a stimulus is a sufficient condition for the enhancement of his attitude towards it. So the more often we are exposed to some stimulus, it's a sufficient condition for increase our liking. And Moreland and Beach did an interesting experiment. They had a student seminar like this one, and they had four confederates of the researcher who were not students at the university, so no one of the other students knew them. One of the students, or one of the confederates, didn't visit the classroom at all. One of the confederates went to the lectures five times, sat in the back of the classroom, didn't ask any questions, didn't engage with the students, and just went home after the lecture. A third confederate visited the lectures 10 times, and the final confederate visited the lecture 15 times. So there was no interaction, there was no engagement. But you see, on almost all the variables, there was highly significant differences. So people said they would know none of these four confederates, which is true, because she never engaged with anyone, she wasn't studying there, so no one could say, yes, I know her. But you see, on all the other variables, are you familiar with her? Would you like to become friends with her? Would you enjoy spending time or working together with her? How similar do you believe this person is? Do you think she has a similar background or similar plans for the future? You see that there are highly significant differences. So the more often the confederate visited the classroom, the more people thought they were familiar with her, would enjoy spending time with her, and thought they had the same or similar backgrounds. So this is a mere exposure effect. And going back maybe to this study, it's not the case that these people become friends because they realize, oh, we have the same hobbies, the same interests, we come from the same place in the United States before we went to Europe. This may also play a role, but also mere exposure helps. And the likelihood that person living in apartment one sees the person in apartment 7 two or three times in the first couple of days a week, walking down or up the staircase, already makes person 1 feel more positive about person 7. And this then, of course, inspires having conversations, having tea with each other, inviting each other into the apartment. And this then makes people finding out whether they like each other. But this can also only happen if we have a slightly positive feeling about them. And this renders this research so important. Even if the effects look small, they can be meaningful, but because small positive effect towards another ethnic group is already a predictor for engaging with these ethnic group, and engaging with these other group members is a precondition for getting to know them. Another factor, so we have proximity, propinquity, mere exposure effect, attractiveness, reciprocal liking. This is one of the most important determinants of our liking. We like someone more if we feel that this person likes us. And there's one interesting study by Aronson and Lindner who had people engage with each other, and confederates of the researcher made various statements, some positive and some negative. And then they evaluated the real participants' liking of the others. If this other person was first making a negative statement or a negative reward, but then turned positive, this had the most positive effects of liking of the confederate. So if you are a research participant and you enter the laboratory and then there's a confederate waiting, and this confederate makes some negative remark to your clothing or your appearance or I don't know, you don't like that. But if this person then makes a very positive statement, you like this person most, compared to when this person is positive all the way, or when this person is negative throughout. But negative throughout is even more liked than when the person first makes a positive statement and then turns negative. But you still see, it's still positive. The liking is still positive in all the conditions. So being around with others helps in liking other people. And we do like when people make positive rewards, but this, when there's a negative-positive or positive-negative reversal, then the people who are first positive and then negative are liked least, and we like those people most who are first negative and then positive. Maybe because this indicates that this is a truthful person. Maybe we think, okay, she's not only saying something positive because she's always positive, or because she's a liar, or because she doesn't want to be negative. If this person is first negative, we think, okay, she seems to be quite an honest person. I don't like that, but she seems honest. And then we take the positive statements that come second more serious and like them more than in the other situation. Yes, please.
I think this is a method of long chiefs. Like the first time they are very hard and authority and very negative. Mm-hmm. Then they know when they are very friendly, they have a much better status.
Okay. Status might also be an effect. So if people are negative, then we may perceive them as higher status in some way, and if they are positive, then we like that more when it comes from higher status people than from lower status people. Okay. So in all these experiments, and particularly Festinger's and Colette van Laar's studies, liking is predicted by proximity. Liking is also predicted by similarity. And when we get to know each other better, other factors kick in more. And this is one key factor, is whether the other person is similar to ourselves. And Newcomb did a similar study than Colette van Laar. Students received rent-free accommodation. Imagine you come to Goethe University and you are offered rent-free accommodation for a semester or for a year. The only condition is you have to participate in our study, which makes you filling in some attitude questionnaires. and Newcomb did this, and what they found was attraction between students was first predicted by proximity, whether they lived together close to each other, but over time, over the term, it was more predicted by similarity than by proximity. So proximity helps getting to know each other, but once we get to know each other, similarity is the relevant criterion. And the final factor is self-disclosure, the sharing of intimate information and feelings with other people. Typically, we disclose to those we like. We tell others we like more about our feelings, and we provide them with more information on our background, etc., when we like them. But we also like those more who disclose to us, and we like those to whom we have disclosed. So when you want to date someone, when you want to get into a relationship with someone you admire, you should tell this person something about you. This makes it more likely that this person will tell you also something to you about her or him. And once she or he has done so, it makes it all more likely that she or he likes you back. Okay? So self-disclosure is important for liking. And the more we disclose, the more we like that person, the more likely it is that they disclose to us. And then liking increases mutually. Theories of attraction and relationships, very quickly, three different theories. Balance theory, we discussed already. Reinforcement theories, you know. And a little bit about social exchange theories. Balance theories, remember Fritz Seider, 1958. Peter, Olivia, and an object. And Peter likes Olivia, Olivia likes the object, opera, football, whatever. And when Peter likes the object too, then the triad is in balance. When Peter does not like Olivia and does not like soccer, but Olivia likes soccer, it's also fine, etc., etc. So what Peter can do if he likes Olivia, in these two cases, he should find objects that he likes and that Olivia likes. That makes it more predictive that Olivia and Peter's relationship maintains and both are satisfied and happy with their relationship than when Peter and Olivia like, respectively dislike, different objects. This would make them constantly fight each other. Who goes to the opera? Shall we go to the football? What's on television? Etc., etc. And when we are constantly in unbalanced triads, then Peter and Olivia would probably lose their positive feelings or increase their negative feelings. This is one theory of why people stay in relationships, maintain relationships. Another theory is the reinforcement effect model. Liking for a person can be the result of evaluative conditioning. This means positive and negative feelings aroused by spatial, temporally contiguous stimuli become linked to the people around us. What does it mean? That means when you are with someone, often in situations that both of you like and enjoy. And what do people do who like each other? They go into the cinema. They go into the opera. They go into nice restaurants and have food together. They holiday together and are on nice beaches and watch the sun go down. And these are the spatial, temporally contiguous stimuli. That means every time I be with her, I'm in some nice atmosphere, either restaurant or cinema or sunrise, sundawn, whatever. And this becomes hardwired in our brain and increases our attraction and liking to the other people. It's some sort of hardwired. It's a little bit with Pavlov's dog and the bell that always comes together with the food that makes the dog salivate. So whenever we see our partner, we tend to start salivating because we remember all these positive things that we have done with her or him. Which does not sound so romantic, doesn't it? It sounds more like we are hardwired animals that cannot escape these situations. And even more, this is even more true for the social exchange perspective. Thibault and Kelly and Rosbaud came up with this theory and applied it to close relationships. This is a theory that how people feel about a relationship depends on their perceptions of the rewards, of the costs, the kind of relationship they think they deserve, which is their comparison level, and their chances for having a better relationship with someone else, which is the comparison level for alternatives. So according to this model, people constantly evaluate what are my benefits, what are the costs that I put into the relationship, what do I expect from an ideal partner, and where does my current partner stand in relation to my ideal and in relation to alternatives? And sometimes there are better alternatives that are closer to my ideal than my current partner. And when my costs exceed the rewards, then I will end the relationship. Sometimes my costs are higher than my rewards, but the alternative that I have in mind is lower than the current partner compared to my ideal, and then I will maintain this relationship. This does particularly not sound very romantic, but research has confirmed this model. So what are the best predictors of the stability of the relationship? The best predictor of whether people will still be together in 5 years is the current commitment to the relationship. So let's assume these people were partners. Then I would ask each of one, how much are you committed to maintain your partnership? And the more they are committed to their partnership today, the more I can predict that they will still be together in 5 years from now. But what does determine their current commitment? The current commitment is determined by their satisfaction with the relationship, and this is determined by the rewards they get out of the relationship, by the costs that they put into the relationship, by their comparison level. And commitment is also predicted by the level of investment in the relationship and the quality of alternatives. And this research has confirmed that this model by and large is true. So we don't run around all the time and put down estimates of costs and rewards, but by and large we have a good estimate of whether it is us who is always investing in the relationship, whereas our partner seems to do nothing, or vice versa. And in both cases we may feel not very satisfied with the relationship, but whether we are still committed to it or not depends on the comparisons that we have in terms of our ideals and alternatives. What are rewards and costs that we are talking about? Came up with a theory here, and they found that these are the resources that can be exchanged in relationships. It can be goods, like products or objects, it can be information, it can be love, money, services, or status. And if we are in very close, intimate relationships, then we exchange different things. If we are in loose relationships, we tend to exchange resources of the same type. So we exchange goods by money, or money by information. When we are in close relationships, think about your partner, think about your children. We exchange love for status, services, goods, etc. One variant of this social exchange theory is equity theory. This holds that people are happiest with relationships in which the rewards and costs that you experience and the contribution that you make are roughly equal to the contributions the other partner makes and experiences. So if you are Peter and you invest three items, whatever that may be, you would still perceive the relationship as equitable and okay, and you would still be committed to your relationship to Olivia, who is only investing one item or entity, as long as Olivia's output is also equivalent to her input and your output or outcome is equivalent to your input. So this would be an equitable relationship, this would be an equitable relationship, and here equity would not be perceived. So here Peter perceives that he is getting more out of the relationship than he invests compared to what Olivia invests and gets out of the relationship. Here Peter gets out less than he invests compared to Olivia. In these situations, likelihood is higher that Peter or Olivia would end the relationship than in equitable relationships. And again, this has been confirmed in this is a model by Barron and Byrne, but has also been confirmed by research. Briefly, let's talk about love. The proponents of love research in social psychology are Hetfield and Walster and also Sternberg. They distinguish love from mere liking. They say there's a difference between when we love each other and when we like each other. That does not sound very revolutionary, does it? But they also differentiated between different kinds of love, and particularly romantic and companionate love. This we can define as feelings of intimacy and affection that we feel for another person when we deeply care about the other person, but we do not necessarily feel passion and arousal in his or her presence. Passionate love is feelings of intense longing, which is accompanied by physiological arousal. And when our love is reciprocated, we feel great fulfillment, sometimes ecstasy. When our love is not reciprocated, when we feel intense longing and physiological arousal, and we feel that the other person does not feel likewise, then we are sad and desperate. And Sternberg put these elements together in his triangular theory of love, which is the idea that different kinds of love consist of varying degrees of the following three components: intimacy, passion, and commitment. And this makes us distinguish, so when we have three different elements, we have nine combinations. And if none of these elements have given, when there's no passion, no commitment, and no intimacy, then there's no love. Simple. When all three elements are given, we talk about consummate love. When there's commitment and intimacy, but no passion, then we are companionate lovers. When there's passion and intimacy, but no commitment, this may be called romantic love. And then there are some forms of empty love or infatuation or fatuous love, where one or two of the elements are given, but one or two others are missing. And we can use this model again. Sternberg has developed questionnaires, and when we do partnership research, we can use these elements to predict whether people will stay together, whether they are happy in their partnerships, etc. Yeah, I already mentioned evolutionary biology, and we cannot ignore this. It's deeply rooted in our genetic makeup, and sometimes we still behave the way we behave because at some stage in the last 100,000 years it was helpful in our reproductive fitness. So the evolutionary approach to love states that men and women are attracted to different characteristics in each other because this helps us being fit to reproduce. And Buss is a proponent of evolutionary theory. He suggests that this approach explains the different strategies of men and women in romantic relationships. And research has found that this is true, but research has also found that this is changing. So typically, as I mentioned very early on, men are looking for physical attributes in their partners. They look for sexy women, whereas women typically look for high status and income. But this is changing. So What has been found recently is that women with more economic power are also more interested in the physical attractiveness of men than status, whereas women with little economic power are still more interested in status and income than physical characteristics of their potential partners. Okay, and now let's briefly discuss the answers to these questions. So men and women have different preferences for the qualities of their partners. Typically, yes, when we ask about ideals, when we ask people about who would you mate with or who would you partner with ideally, then we still would find some differences. As I told you, maybe even with your three qualities, three characteristics, overall, I would probably find more references to physical attractiveness and physical characteristics for the man than for the female's characteristics. And vice versa, maybe the women in this room have noted a few more items that refer to income, status, security, and these things than the man would have put down. As Conley and others write, research shows that this difference disappears completely if we ask people about their actual partners. If we ask people about the actual partners, this difference disappears. Second question, do men think about more often about sex than women do? Yes, they do. So Fisher, Moore, and Pittinger, they asked both female and male undergraduates to carry around little pocket computers, and every time when a signal appeared, they should briefly note down their last thought, the last thought that they had. And then the researchers classified all the answers they got, and what they found was, yes, men thought about sex much more often than women, but they also thought more about sleep and food more often than women. So the interpretation of this is men think about their own needs more than women. Men are apparently more focused on their own person and their own personal needs than women are. And the researchers interpret this with the way we educate our children. And girls are typically trained and rewarded for paying attention to others, whereas boys are typically rewarded for, becoming superheroes. Do women desire less and actually have fewer sexual partners than men? Typically, these are men and these are women. Typically, we look at the mean as the variable to determine whether men or women desire more sexual partners. And if we take the mean, then men desire many more partners on average than women. But you can see that the distribution is completely different for men and women, and the mean for men is grossly exaggerated because there are some men who desire a very high number of sexual partners. So on average, if we take the median tells us half of the population is below the median, the other half of the population is above the median. The median is exactly one, both for men and women. So the median is, both for men and women, one partner, which makes some sense, I guess. If we take the mean, then it's much higher for men than it is for women. For women, the median is the same as the mean. For men, it's something like 2 point something or 3 point something, because there are some men who say they desire 10 or 20 or 50 or whatever. Now, what happens if we ask men and women about their actual sexual partners? How many people do you currently have sex with? Not simultaneously, but in a week or in the recent couple of months. And here researchers have distinguished or have subdivided the group of people they asked, and they have put half of the people in a condition where they thought that the researchers could read their minds. So they used a bogus pipeline condition in which they hardwired men and women to an instrument that apparently could tell the truth. In the condition in which people were not wired to this instrument, men again exaggerated the number of sexual partners vastly, whereas women had much lower numbers, on average one. In the condition where men and women were hardwired, the difference disappeared altogether. So men were more honest and said, okay, one partner only. Women orgasm less frequently than men. There's one large study, there were many, many different studies, but there's one large study by Armstrong and colleagues. They surveyed almost 13,000 undergraduates. And they asked both men and women how often they would experience orgasms when being sexually active. And they found that women are experiencing orgasms much less. But then they looked more closely into the different types of relationships men and women were in. And what they found was in first-time hookups, some sort of one-night stands, women orgasm only in 32 of the cases that men orgasm. Men orgasm almost always. So for women, it's 32% of this almost always. In repeated hookups, it increases to 49%. And in committed relationships, so those women who were together with the same partner for a longer time, women orgasmed 79% of the cases that men orgasmed. So women can orgasm as much and as often as men do. It just depends on the type of relationships. And it appears that women in committed relationships experience orgasms much more than their fellow females, because their partners know what to do. There's more foreplay, etc. I don't go into more details here. Do men like casual sex more than women? Again, classic study, Clark and Hatfield, 1989. Research confederates walked around university campus and approached female and male students. And they said, would you like to have sex with me tonight? 70% of all men approached said yes. And some of them said, why tonight? Why not now? No single woman said yes. Some of the women told the person in very rude terms to go away and leave them alone. But does it tell us that women indeed do not want to have casual sex, or are men just more honest, or what are the reasons for this effect? One reason women were surveyed afterwards, and one reason was that women have two problems with being approached and asked whether they would like to have sex. One problem is they fear to be stigmatized. You don't do that as a lady. And if you take away the risk of others observing you and feeling stigmatized, then women's desire to have casual sex increases. The other problem, or the other fact that makes women agreeing less to having casual sex in experiments like these is, when you are approached by a stranger who asks you about sex, as a man, this is not so much of a problem because your chance of orgasm is there anyway. As a woman, you may think, this person is only asking me because he probably does not have other alternatives, so maybe this person is less sexually capable, and he will not make me satisfied and happy. Moritz, is that all on video? Okay, but I'm only referring to Terry Conley and her colleagues. I think they are all female, or most of them. So if you take away these two facts, and if you ask women whether they would agree to have casual sex with people they know and they believe are sexually capable, and if you reduce or take away the risk of being stigmatized, the numbers are equal for men and women. So there's no difference in desire, there's only a difference in calculations between men and women. And the final question, I think, are women choosier? Are they more selective than men? Yes, they are, but this is because women are trained to wait for being approached by men, and men are trained and educated and rewarded for approaching women. And when we are in a situation that we are approached, we can afford to be selective, apparently. And in one research study, people have used these speed dating arrangements where you meet 20 people of the other sex within half an hour, and then you can choose one or two, I don't know. And what the researchers worried was whether the men were the ones shifting around and approaching the women. That is a typical setup. The women are waiting somewhere to be approached by their potential partners. And having the women walk around and approach the men. And in the latter condition, men were as choosy as the women in the traditional setup. So it's not the case that men and women are more choosy because of long-standing, hardwired evolutionary reasons, spreading their gene pool less widely or whatever. It's simply our education and our training. And if you are always approached, you can afford to be a little bit less picky. If you are the one who is approaching others, you hope that the partner is less choosy than you typically are. That was it for today. I hope you enjoyed it. I wish you a good week and see you next week for the revision.